Embodying the mind. I always try to get patients to see standard medical treatments such as radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery as energy that can heal them. Many of the disagreements over the worth of alternative therapies arise because some people heal themselves no matter what external aids they choose, as long as they have hope and some control over the therapy. I support them as long as a patient has chosen them with a positive conviction, not out of fear. When a patient says, "I'm scared to death of surgery," and therefore chooses something else, I can't support that choice. Affirmation aids the body. Fear is destructive. Treatment chosen out of fear is unlikely to be helpful. I try to get patients to understand that the body heals, not the therapy. All healing is scientific. At a recent conference, someone told me he knew someone on a macrobiotic diet, someone else on a diet exactly the opposite, and a third person on chemotherapy and radiation. All three got well, and this person couldn't understand how the body could accomplish this or how the treatments made any sense. But the body can utilize any form of energy for healing, even plain water, as long as the patient believes in it. Let's say I recommended eating 3 peanut butter sandwiches a day to cure cancer. Some people would get well and claim it was the peanut butter that did it. Then even more people would have hope, eat peanut butter, and get better too. But we know it's not the peanut butter. It's their hope and the changes they produce in their lives while they're on the new therapy. The most important thing is to pick a therapy you believe in and proceed with a positive attitude. Each person must chart his own course. One may want a comprehensive nutritional supplement program, while another thinks taking dozens of pills a day is too much of a nuisance, and it becomes counterproductive. Some can just leave their troubles to God and be healed. Since cancer patients typically feel little control over their lives, to the point where their own cells are in revolt, the mere fact of making a choice can itself be a turning point. Group discussion is also immensely helpful in convincing patients that they can choose a course that feels right to them. In ECAP, we have had people on Laetril, vitamin C, strict diets, standard therapy only, and some on no medical therapy at all. At first, I was worried that people would argue over who was doing the right thing. Instead, they all share the belief that they will get well. However, many actions, such as nutritional supplementation, exercise, and meditation, are valuable aids to any treatment and therefore are important parts of the ECAP program. Minimizing side effects. I don't try to browbeat people into receiving radiation or chemotherapy if they think these are toxic, because they'll prove themselves right. They'll have every possible side effect and then say, "Look, what this has done to me. I shouldn't have listened to you." Or they'll resist more directly by simply flushing the medicine down the toilet. Dr. Alexandra Levine found that 60% of patients in a survey she conducted had no trace of medication in their blood samples. Yet chemotherapy statistics are based on the assumption that all patients take their drugs. Many oncologists now insist that patients take the pills under supervision, but an open, trusting relationship would be better. In my opinion, about 3/4 of the side effects of radiation and chemotherapy result from patients' negative beliefs fostered by a destructive kind of hypnosis on the part of the physician. Most doctors say something like, "All these bad things can happen to you, and if you're lucky, something good might happen." No good hypnotherapist would ever write a protocol like those usually given to cancer patients. All the things that are going to go wrong are listed first, so everybody is put into a no mode. By the time you get to the bottom of the page where it suggests that good things may happen, you continue to say, "No, no, no." Nobody's going to sue a doctor for accenting the positive, and the physician doesn't have to make any guarantees. All that's necessary is to change the emphasis. A lot of good things can happen because of this treatment. It is possible the following adverse effects may occur, but I don't expect them. That way, patients will be saying, "Yes, yes, yes," and then at the bottom of the page, they'll be convinced they're unlikely to have any of the following side effects. Patients should also be reminded that normal cells can recover from the strong medicines better than weak, sensitive cancer cells. Negative programming is one reason why 1/4 of all chemotherapy patients start throwing up before they get to their next treatment. Behavioral scientists have shown that the techniques used to conquer phobias can eliminate this anticipatory nausea, but they are usually not needed when chemotherapy is given in a sharing doctor-patient relationship, along with imagery training and attention to the patient's emotional problems. Effective beliefs. Beliefs shape the power of the treatment as well as the seriousness of its side effects. ECAP's main goal is to foster the kind of autonomy and awareness in patients and their loved ones to achieve the peace of mind that enables them to deal with life's issues. In ECAP, we promote these changes in weekly two-hour group meetings. ECAP is a nonprofit corporation. We charge a modest fee to defray costs, but anyone who cannot afford it is admitted free. No physician's referral is needed, and no one is ever turned away. The only admission requirements are that people do the drawings and fill out the admission form with the four questions and request for historical information. Each member begins by doing a drawing of himself, his disease, his white blood cells, and his treatment. We then discuss these drawings in at least one individual session before the patient joins one of the groups. In our group sessions, we discuss every aspect of our lives, treatment goals and options, nutrition, exercise, the psychological origins of disease, management of pain and fear, and techniques of stress reduction. We help patients set goals for their lives, find occasions for play and laughter, deal with sexual problems, and develop an emotional support system among friends and family. Like AA, we provide an instant family, which is non-judgmental. In general, we discuss why we're alive and what we're here for. Each session closes with a period of meditation and guided imagery, and we help patients adapt these techniques for their daily use. The ECAP family is often more loving and supportive than the biological one. An oncologist once asked me, "Since you're not trained in psychotherapy, how do you know you won't do these patients harm?" I replied, "I love them. I may not help them, but I'm sure I won't hurt them." ECAP can be supplemented by further psychotherapy. We will now turn to the externals of the program, methods for changing what you do. We will later explore the internals, ways to change who you are. Please keep in mind that most of the discussion concerns cancer because, as a surgeon, I see many cancer patients. However, I believe that the same practices improve the prospects in all diseases. And in ECAP, we have seen positive results with diabetes, scleroderma, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, neurologic disorders, obesity, asthma, AIDS, cancer. Good nutrition is an essential part of any treatment program, but I don't believe in prescribing a strict regimen for all patients. In general, I recommend the type of diet advocated by the late health researcher Nathan Pritikin, which is the type eaten in countries where people regularly live to be 100, or one based on the dietary guidelines prepared by the American Institute for Cancer Research and endorsed by the National Academy of Sciences. I don't force vegetarianism on patients. I think one's mental and spiritual outlook is more important to health than any particular diet, although vegetarians with cancer do have better survival statistics. Exercise. People who exercise regularly have fewer illnesses than sedentary persons. In the hospital, those who get up and walk as soon as possible are the ones who recover most quickly from surgery. Exercise, especially running, walking, swimming, and other repetitive types, offers a chance to meditate because we don't have to think about what we're doing. This will benefit anyone as long as the exercise doesn't become a way to run away from problems or an excuse to stay away from one's family. Exercise has been successfully used to treat depression, and for the same reasons, it is a potent weapon against physical afflictions. The type and amount can only be worked out on an individual basis. I recommend 1/2 hour to 1 hour daily or every other day, according to what is comfortable for the individual. Just remember that a sick body demands a slower pace than a healthy one. Warning signals of pain or excessive fatigue must be heeded, but they're signs to ease up, not to stop entirely. The most important thing is that if exercise becomes work, it defeats its purpose. When you can't exercise, you can visualize yourself exercising, and this stimulates your body also. I utilize this technique on long drives. play and laughter. Laughter makes the unbearable bearable, and a patient with a well-developed sense of humor has a better chance of recovery than a stolid individual who seldom laughs. There are sound scientific reasons why we call robust, unrestrained laughter hearty. It produces complete, relaxed action of the diaphragm, exercising the lungs, increasing the blood's oxygen level, and gently toning the entire cardiovascular system. Norman Cousins termed it internal jogging, and others have likened it to a deep massage. All the muscles of the chest, abdomen, and face get a little workout, and if the joke is a real knee slapper, even the arms and legs reap the benefits. After the laughter, all the muscles are relaxed, including the heart, pulse rate, and blood pressure temporarily decline. Physiologists have found that muscle relaxation and anxiety cannot exist together, and the relaxation response after a good laugh has been measured as lasting as long as 45 minutes. According to some scientific studies, laughter also increases the production of a class of brain chemicals called catecholamines. These include the compounds that, in some circumstances, stimulate the fight-or-flight response, which may inhibit healing. However, increased amounts of some of these compounds in the blood can also reduce inflammation by activating a different part of the immune system. In addition, they increase the production of endorphins, the body's natural opiates. It appears that these are two of the things that happen during laughter. Thus, humor may relieve pain directly by physiological means, as well as by diverting our attention and helping us to relax. Since nearly every hospital room has a TV set, I hope someday we have a healing channel that includes plenty of comedy, as well as music, meditation, and healing imagery. Psychologists have long noted that one of the best measures of mental health is the ability to laugh at oneself in a gently mocking way. Julie, a young lady who came to ECAP because of blindness resulting from diabetes, showed us all how laughter makes life better. Once, when out to dinner at a restaurant, her family and friends sat her down in a chair, and she, presuming the table was in front of her, inched her chair forward. She kept inching and inching and ended up across the room. Everyone was silent, not knowing how to respond. Finally, she bumped into another table where the people asked, "Would you like to join us?" As soon as she realized what had happened, she started laughing and the whole restaurant exploded in laughter. One day, Julie was walking with her boyfriend who kept telling her, "Be careful, step down, step up." He was so concerned about her that he fell off the curb, so she handed him her cane and said, "Here, you need this more than I do." Julie has since regained her sight, truly a healing miracle, and no longer fears blindness. Her statement to me was, "Blindness taught me to see, and death taught me to live." She is now one of our co-therapists. Exercise, laughter, and play are closely related. All three need to be approached in much the same spirit. All three produce similar effects on body and mind. When someone draws his emotions as a little black box or a tight red circle, it's easy to see how restricted the expression of feeling can be. The same is true of positive feelings. As adults, many people must struggle to overcome a lifetime of conditioning and destructive messages such as, "Be brave," "Be perfect," "Hurry up," "Try harder," "Be strong," and "Please me." Consequently, many people have to work at playing. We must learn to give fun a high priority in life. Like all other positive change, this also develops from the essential first step, learning to love ourselves. Each of us must take the time to find humorous books or movies, play the games we enjoy, tell jokes to friends, doodle, or have fun with coloring books, whatever the choice is of the child inside you. Focusing the mind for healing. Among many psychological techniques applied to physical illness, the most widely used and successful has been the one called imaging or visualization. I will discuss relaxation, hypnosis, meditation, and visualization separately, but they are really all part of one process, as you'll understand when practicing them. Relaxation. By relaxation, I don't mean falling asleep in front of the TV set or unwinding with friends. The kind I'm talking about is a quieting of mental activity and withdrawal of body and mind from external stimulation. Inducing this state is the first step in hypnosis, biofeedback, yogic meditation, and most related forms of mind exploration. There are many methods of relaxation, nearly all of them quite similar. One method differs somewhat from most of the others. Dr. Ainsley Mears of Melbourne, Australia, believes that all verbal instructions, even in the beginning, tend to stimulate too much logical thought. He has reported several remarkable regressions of cancer using a nonverbal quieting method based on gentle touching and reassuring sounds by the therapist. He also believes that best results depend on a slight degree of discomfort to be overcome by the patient, such as that produced by sitting on a low stool or straight-backed chair. Healing touch can certainly be significant when the patient has someone to administer it regularly, but other ways of inducing the relaxation response also achieve excellent results. Don't be discouraged if you find relaxation procedures hard at first. Relaxation and meditation are perhaps especially difficult for Americans. Our constant mental diet of advertising, noise, violence, and media stimulation makes it very difficult to endure even a few minutes of inactivity and quiet. We have created a wall around ourselves to block out this deluge. In the process, we also stop feeling, and the quiet can be threatening. It gives us time to think and feel again. Meditation. Someone once said, "Prayer is talking, meditation is listening." Actually, it's a method by which we can temporarily stop listening to the pressures and distractions of everyday life and thereby are able to acknowledge other things, our deeper thoughts and feelings, the products of our unconscious mind, the peace of pure consciousness and spiritual awareness. To call it listening makes it sound entirely passive, but meditation is also an active process, although not in the usual sense. It is a way of focusing the mind in a state of relaxed awareness that, although less responsive to distractions, is more focused than usual toward things we want to pay attention to. There are many ways of doing this. Some teachers recommend focusing your attention on a symbolic sound or word, a mantra, or on a single image, such as a candle flame or a mandala. Others focus on the relaxed ebb and flow of the breath, or gently restrain the mind from following the thoughts that flicker across its surface. The end of all the methods is ultimately the same, a deeply restful emptiness or trance that strengthens the mind by freeing it from its accustomed turmoil. With guidance and practice, meditation can lead to breathtaking experiences of cosmic at-oneness and enlightenment, but the changes in the beginning are typically gentle and subtle. As you begin meditating, you'll find that it improves your concentration. Gradually, you become centered within yourself, so that you no longer react so strongly to outside stresses. When someone cuts you off on the highway, you can avoid or shorten that hair-trigger surge of frustrated anger and its corresponding rise in blood pressure. The calmness also leaves you better prepared to avoid danger from other people's foolish actions. I know of no other single activity that by itself can produce such a great improvement in the quality of life. In 1980, psychologist Albert Villoldo of San Francisco State College showed that subjects trained in meditation were able to stop bleeding immediately after a blood test merely by focusing their minds on the vein after the needle was removed. This is easy to do, and I suggest that each of you try it the next time you have a blood sample drawn. Visualization and hypnosis. Anthropologist Claude Levi Strauss has noted that much of folk medicine throughout the world is based on psychological manipulation of the sick organ by means of an extremely vivid image brought into the mind while the patient is in a deep trance. Carl and Stephanie Simonton adopted similar techniques learned from Silver Mind Control after learning that users of biofeedback often were able to communicate more effectively with their bodies by means of an image than by directly trying to influence a certain organ or function. One woman, for example, learned to control a dangerous irregularity in her heartbeat by picturing a little girl swinging rhythmically to and fro on a playground swing. In Beyond Biofeedback, Elmer and Elise Green of the Menninger Clinic described their experience after being called in to help a man deal with the pain of a large pelvic cancer. They hypnotized him and asked him to find the room in his brain that had the valves controlling the blood supply to his body, and to turn off the valve that controlled the blood flow to his tumor. He did, and the tumor shrank to 1/4 its original size. His pain went away, and he was discharged from the hospital instead of dying. Subsequently, when the man died because of a complication of later surgery, doctors found that his diffuse metastatic disease had disappeared, and his tumor, which had been the size of a grapefruit, was down to the size of a golf ball. Besides using music and meditation, we begin each ECAP session with some calming music. Recordings of natural environments, such as the sea or bird songs in a forest, or even white noise, like that of a waterfall, are also effective. The main concerns are that the sounds be quieting rather than stimulating, that they please the person who's hearing them. This makes it easier to enter the state of loving confrontation we are trying to achieve. Even though it may be helpful, however, you don't need music for visualization. Often, the environmental noises can be woven into the imagery or hypnotic suggestion and help deepen the trance. From years of experience in using the visualization technique, we do know that the image must be chosen by the individual. It must be an image with which the patient feels completely comfortable. A majority of people are profoundly disturbed by any picture of themselves killing anything, even an invading disease organism. Medical jargon words like assault, insult, blast, poison, and kill cause conscious and unconscious rejection by the patient. Thus, some patients do well seeing their white blood cells as sharks or polar bears, but many do not. Some of the most successful kinds of visualization in ECAP have been images of tumors as food, being eaten by white cells disguised as Pac-Man or some such benevolent consumer. Just as healers in primitive tribes tell people to utilize power animals, I suggest that patients use similar animated symbols. One child saw his cancer as cat food and immune cells as white pussycats. Another patient visualized birds and birdseed. One lady who had oat cell cancer pictured mares and does eating her oats. Seeing the cancer as being eaten can mean, this tumor will nourish me and help me get well. This kind of picture is truer to the real nature of the white blood cells and also offers a framework for using the disease as psychological food for one's own growth. Becoming exceptional. Survivors of illness. The Simontons have summarized the psychological profile of their exceptional patients as follows. They are generally successful at careers they like, and they remain employed during illness or return to work soon. They are receptive and creative, but sometimes hostile, having strong egos and a sense of their own adequacy. They have a high degree of self-esteem and self-love. They are rarely docile. They retain control of their lives. They are intelligent with a strong sense of reality. They are self-reliant. They don't need to be included among others, although they value interactions with others. They tend to be nonconformists with a permissive morality. They are unprejudiced, and they appreciate diversity among other people. As patients, those who have or are developing survival traits are self-reliant and seek solutions rather than lapsing into depression. They interpret problems as redirections, not failures. They are the ones who read or meditate in the waiting room instead of staring forlornly into space. As an ECAP member once put it, pessimism is a luxury I can't afford. Our goal in ECAP is to help people live by developing the resilience, adaptability, and confidence of the survivor personality. One of my patients told me she'd asked her doctor whether anybody ever got over what she had. I confronted her with the question, if you were in a concentration camp, would you ask a guard, does anybody ever get out of here? Self-respect and creativity. Psychologists estimate that less than 20% of the population has an inner locus of control, the kind of self-possession in which persons are guided by their own standards rather than beliefs about what others may think. This integrity is a large part of the survivor personality. Becoming your own person releases your creativity. Freed from the bonds of convention and the fear of what others may think, the mind responds with new solutions, new goals, and an awareness that beauty and peace come from within. We all have the opportunity to live inventively. People who develop their full individuality often change jobs, moving from a career that bores them but gives them security into one that brings meaning to their lives and provides them with a way of giving something to the world rather than just getting something from it. People who suffer in unsatisfying jobs are assuming the victim role. Nothing is going to help them if they don't help themselves. Too much is made of work defined as a job anyway. People often come into my office and say, "I'd like to be a therapist. Where can I do this work?" I say, "Where do you work now?" When they tell me, I say, "Okay, now look around you, and you'll find that everyone in that office has pain. Help them, and you'll immediately become a therapist." This is another area where meditation and visualization can be of enormous help. A person can temporarily disconnect from the pressures and unhappiness of the present job and image a more congenial future. Imaging channels mental energy toward making the desired result happen, and as you begin to act upon your new awareness, you create new opportunities, both consciously and unconsciously. We prepare our future by what we think and do each day. I recommend that patients keep a diary of their thoughts. As they read it later, they will see how they prepared their future by their thoughts, which then motivated their activities. Jung said, "The future is unconsciously prepared long in advance and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance." Independence and assertiveness. People who always smile, never tell anyone their troubles, and neglect their own needs are the ones who are most likely to become ill. For them, the main problem often is learning to say no without guilt. Many only become able to live for themselves, tell others what they really feel, after the shock of the diagnosis. The most important kind of assertiveness a patient can demonstrate is in the formation of a participatory relationship with the doctor. Most patients don't talk to their doctors or ask a lot of questions for fear of angering this person who is going to make them well. Of course, no one can make you well. You heal. Many people get well while using alternative therapies. This does not necessarily mean that the therapy itself is useful, but that people heal doing something they believe in, something that gives them hope. That's what we help people learn in ECAP, and it often means helping doctors learn the same lesson. One morning on rounds, a patient asked me, "What's wrong?" "Nothing," I said. "Then why are you frowning?" "I'm not frowning, just thinking." "Well, do your thinking in the hallway and smile in here." Our patients are our best teachers. When a nurse tells me that some patient is being uncooperative, refusing to get undressed and put on the standard hospital gown, or asking all sorts of questions before submitting to a test, I say, "Fine, he'll live longer." The so-called problem patient is also the rapid healer, the long-term survivor, and the one with the active immune system. That's why I encourage people to behave as individuals when they enter a hospital. By following this list of suggestions, which my wife and I call good patient, bad patient. 1. For your hospital stay, take clothes that are practical, comfortable, and individual. Plan to walk as much as possible. 2. Take room decorations of a personal and inspirational nature. Make sure your room has a view of the sky and the outside world. Do not accept a room that faces a brick wall. 3. Question authority. Speak up for yourself, your needs, and comfort in all areas, both before and during tests. 4. Make your doctor aware of your unique needs and desires. Offer to share books, tapes, and conversation. 5. Take tape recorder and earphones along with meditation tapes and some of your favorite music. Record conversations with your physician for later review and for family use. 6. Use your tape recorder in the operating room and recovery room to hear music, meditation, or messages during and after surgery. Have someone put a reminder into the doctor's orders to play the entire tape continuously. 7. If you are having an operation, instruct the surgeon and anesthesiologist to repeat positive messages to you. The simplest is that you will awaken comfortable, thirsty, and hungry. 8. Tell the surgeon to speak to you during surgery, honestly but hopefully, and also to repeat positive messages, but absolutely avoid negative ones. 9. Speak to your body, particularly the night before surgery, suggesting that the blood leave the area of surgery and that you'll heal rapidly. 10. Arrange visits and calls from those who will nurture and love you, as well as give you care frontation when appropriate. 11. Get moving as soon as possible after surgery. Leave the hospital to attend group meetings, go for walks, or have meals out with friends. for faith. I believe faith is the essence, a simple solution, yet too hard for most people to practice. To verify this, I went to God. Surgeons have that prerogative. And asked why I couldn't hang a sign in my waiting room saying, "Leave your troubles to God, you don't need me." God said, "I'll show you why. I'll meet you at the hospital at 10 a.m. Saturday." He likes to play doctor. On Saturday, he said, "Take me to your sickest patient." I told him about a woman with cancer whose husband had run off with another woman. He said, "Good case," and we went up to her room. I said, "Ma'am, God is going to come in and tell you how to get well." I always introduce him so patients are not overwhelmed. She responded, "Oh, wonderful." God entered the room and said, "All you have to do is love, accept, forgive, and choose to be happy." And she looked him in the eye and said, "Have you met my husband yet?" Most of us want God to change the external aspects of our lives so we don't have to change internally. We want to be exempt from the responsibility for our own happiness. We often find it easier to resent and suffer in the role of victim than to love, forgive, accept, and find inner peace. Yet, when we choose to love, healing energy is released in our bodies. Energy itself is loving and intelligent and available to all of us. Now I felt I had a dilemma. If God's love could cure people, I wondered, why should I remain a surgeon? So I returned to him and said, "God, you know, one of my patients got well, leaving her troubles to you. Why should I remain a surgeon? Why not just teach people to love?" And God, in his beautiful, sweet, melodious voice, said, "Bernie, render unto the surgeon what is the surgeon's, and render unto God what is God's." I find that God does that a lot, speaks in parables, and leaves you totally confused. Since then, I've come to understand that God and I both have a role in getting people well. Let me illustrate what I mean with an old story I've adapted. A man with cancer is told by his primary physician he'll be dead in an hour. He runs to the window, looks up at the sky, and says, "God, save me." Out of the blue comes that wonderful melodious voice saying, "Don't worry, my son, I will save you." The man climbs back into bed feeling reassured. His physician called me, and I walk in and say, "If I operate in an hour, I can save you." "No thanks," says the man, "God will save me." Then an oncologist, radiation therapist, nutritional therapist all tell him, "We can save you. I don't need you. God will save me," was his reply to all of them. In an hour, he's dead. When he gets to heaven, he walks up to God and says, "What happened? You said you'd save me, and I'm dead." And God said, "You dumbbell. I sent you a surgeon, an oncologist, radiation therapist, nutritional therapist." There is a role for the mechanic when he is the patient's choice of therapy. I can be God's gift and tool also, just as the Bible states medication is. In ECAP, we found that four faiths are crucial to recovery from serious illness. Faith in oneself, one's doctor, one's treatment, and one's spiritual faith. We have discussed the first three, but the last, although seldom totally achievable by most of us, is in many ways a key to the others. The spiritual life has many meanings. It need not be reflected in any commitment to an organized religion, and we all know that some of the most outwardly pious people are the least spiritual. These are the ones who give other people spiritual ulcers, as a participant in one of my workshops phrased it. From the standpoint of a healer, I view spirituality as including the belief in some meaning or order in the universe. I view the force behind creation as a loving, intelligent energy. For some, this is labeled God. For others, it can be seen simply as a source of healing. From this, there comes the ability to find peace, to resolve the apparent contradictions between one's emotions and reality, between internal and external. Spirituality means acceptance of what is, not to be confused with resignation or approval of evil. Jesus told us to love our enemies, not like them, and not have no enemies. In an abandoned, bombed-out house in Germany at the end of World War II, Allied soldiers found a testimony scratched into a basement wall by one of the victims of the Holocaust. I believe in the sun, even when it does not shine. I believe in love, even when it is not shown. I believe in God, even when he does not speak. Spirituality means the ability to find peace and happiness in an imperfect world, and to feel that one's own personality is imperfect but acceptable. From this peaceful state of mind come both creativity and the ability to love unselfishly, which go hand in hand. Acceptance, faith, forgiveness, peace, and love are the traits that define spirituality for me. These characteristics always appear in those who achieve unexpected healing of serious illness. I encourage patients to have faith in God, but not to expect Him to do all the work. I know that many patients, when they develop an illness or have a recurrence, are angry at God. It's important to be able to argue with God. Continued helpless rage at the universe can't possibly lead to help. God is not sitting up there with a clipboard saying, "Let's see who I can make trouble for today." On the contrary, God is a resource. The energy of hope and faith is always available. We all must die someday, but the spiritual way is always open to everyone and can make our lives beautiful whenever we choose it. Unconditional love. I feel that all disease is ultimately related to a lack of love, or to love that is only conditional. For the exhaustion and depression of the immune system thus created leads to physical vulnerability. I also feel that all healing is related to the ability to give and accept unconditional love. This was strikingly borne out in the story of one of my cervical cancer patients, a secretary named Sherry. As a child, Sherry felt unloved by her stepmother, and as a teenager, she formed a strong attachment to one of her teachers. One day, in the school gym, Sherry told some of her friends that she loved Mrs. Johnson. Some of the children told the teacher, "Sherry loves you," and she called Sherry into her office. "Sherry, do you love me from near or far?" Mrs. Johnson asked. The girl didn't know what the woman was talking about, so she said, "From near." Mrs. Johnson then called Sherry's stepmother and told her that her daughter was a lesbian. When Sherry came home from school that day, her stepmother confronted her with the information, as she later told me. "I didn't know what lesbian meant, but I got the message that love gets you in trouble, and I decided to stop loving." Sherry lost her friends and became so lonely and desperate that she said she would get dressed and walk the streets hoping people would look out their windows and wave at her. When she finally got married, she couldn't believe in her husband's love and kept asking him over and over if he loved her. "I know if I hadn't developed cancer," she said, "he would have left me." The impact of the disease, as well as group therapy and ECAP, enabled Sherry to change her outlook. She opened her heart to love, revitalized her marriage, and made a stand against her illness. She was doing very well and had even gone back to work until her birthday. With six children, her husband and her father-in-law all living in the same house, there was not one present for Sherry. Everybody had a reason, but underneath they were all saying, "We're getting used to your being dead." She hid her pain and despair from everyone, and 2 months later, she had a recurrence. Once, when I visited her soon afterward, she told me she was so upset about dying because I'm trying to prove what you're doing is right. She was still trying to stay alive for the wrong reasons, to please other people instead of herself, and all because of the lack of real love in her formative years. She and her husband were never able to share their deepest feelings, though I kept trying to help them do so. Once I gave a talk near Sherry's office and told them I dedicated to her, hoping the whole family would come. Her husband wrote me a note saying, "I'm sorry I'm busy that night, but call me if you want to." However, the note had no name, address, or phone number. Its unconscious message was, "Don't call me." When I can get people to accept themselves as whole individuals, lovable as they are, they become able to give from an inner strength. They find that unconditional love does not subtract from some limited emotional storehouse. Instead, it multiplies itself. It feels good to give. It makes the recipient feel good, and sooner or later, it returns. Unconditional love is the most powerful known stimulant of the immune system. If I told patients to raise their blood levels of immune globulins or killer T cells, no one would know how. But if I can teach them to love themselves and others fully, the same changes happen automatically. The truth is, love heals. I realized this intuitively many years ago during my residency. A gentleman with severe staphylococcal pneumonia and empyema, an accumulation of pus in the chest, had gone into cardiac arrest. I gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. When I came out of the room, the nurses were all shaking their heads and saying, "You're going to get sick. How could you do that?" I had a feeling then that my body would resist the infection because I had acted out of love for the man, and indeed I didn't get sick. Years later, I heard an account of a nearly identical experience by Dr. Jerry Jampolsky of the Center for Attitudinal Healing in California. As a part of his training, Jerry was sent to a tuberculosis sanitarium. He was frightened that he would contract the disease and decided he could take a deep breath when he got there and hold it for 3 months. One night, he was called to see a woman with active tuberculosis who'd had a massive pulmonary hemorrhage and cardiac arrest. He gave her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and the nurses told him, "How could you do that? Now you're going to get tuberculosis." He never did, and he realized that he was not vulnerable while he was doing something for someone out of love. His realization strengthened mine, and now I've come to understand that this is why Mother Teresa and dedicated nurses can work among hundreds of sick, infected people every day without becoming ill. As the medieval German mystic Meister Eckhart wrote, "The bodily food we take is changed into us, but the spiritual food we receive changes us into itself. Therefore, divine love is not taken into us, for that would make two things, but divine love takes us into itself, and we are one with it." Emotional support. We encourage spouses, relatives, and friends of patients to attend ECAP meetings. We have to understand that, in a sense, everyone has the disease when it strikes one family member. The people in a patient's emotional support network often need to be educated, too. Many people simply don't know how to relate to someone who has a life-threatening illness. The only essential, really, is an honest optimism. Patients need people to help them keep sight of their hopes and the joys that are possible as long as life goes on. But patients sometimes need to gently remind friends and loved ones that a false determination to be constantly upbeat, no matter what the situation, is destructive. It's equally important for couples to continue some form of physical intimacy through illness. Like many of the elderly, severely ill patients often suffer from skin starvation, a literal separation from life when touching stops. If lovemaking becomes difficult, there are usually alternative ways of sexual gratification possible within a couple's values, ingenuity, and physical condition. Caresses, hugs, kisses, and hand-holding are always possible. Transcending fear. To unblock the fountain of love and enter on the path of creative spiritual growth, we must let go of our fears, leave our troubles to God. It is necessary for those dealing with illness to reaffirm themselves constantly with positive messages. A patient needs to stop getting up every day saying, "I have cancer, I'm too weak or depressed to do anything," and start saying instead, "Today can be beautiful. Today can be different because of the cancer. The disease can be a motivator for change." Letting go of fear is the sticking point for many people. It's easier if you see every interchange as either a request for or a giving of love. To hate is easy, but it is healthier to love. When you're feeling afraid, if you ask someone for a hug, for some love, the fear will quiet down. Love is incredibly powerful in the midst of conflict. In most families, I have no trouble getting people to say, "I hate you." "I love you" is much harder. Patients often must say it by letter or phone before they can say it face-to-face, because it's the "I love you" that carries the real emotional power. I know a woman named Emily who was so fearful she wouldn't go out in the rain. She wouldn't sign checks either. She avoided almost all of life's joys and responsibilities. Her husband finally left her, and you couldn't blame him. Then she developed leukemia and went through an incredible metamorphosis. When last seen, she was at a political rally yelling at the top of her lungs. Her husband would remarry the woman she has become, but it took leukemia to get her to wake up and live. For many people, it takes the knowledge that we won't live forever. So why be afraid to love? Transcending hate. Resentments and hate are the obstacles that keep many people from clearing up their unfinished emotional business and achieving harmony with others. Transcending fear opens the way to forgiveness of those who have wronged you, and it releases a love that can make you psychologically immune to your environment. Among my patients, I meet many who are dealing with impossible spouses. There are two ways out. You can either divorce your Hitler or stay and try to change him or her with love. When you realize that both you and your Hitler are only human, you can probably learn to live together, helping each other change. Nothing helps someone become better as much as someone else granting the possibility. As Goethe wrote, "If you treat an individual as he is, he will stay that way. But if you treat him as if he were what he could be, he'll become what he could be." You have to remember that you cannot change anyone. You can only change yourself. But remember, you create the other person by what you're like. Taking care of unfinished business may someday come to be recognized as the most effective pain reliever in preparation for surgery. When speaking at workshops, I often ask, if you knew you were going to die on the way home, would you need to use the phone? If the answer is yes, I say, okay, if you promise when you get home to pick up the phone and make all those calls, I'll guarantee a safe trip home. The ability to see something good in adversity is perhaps the central trait needed by patients. Death or the threat of death has been called the ultimate teacher, for it goads us into appreciating to the utmost what we have or can do today. A daughter, Carolyn, said to me one day at breakfast, Dad, do you ever think who will die first? I said, that's not the issue. The issue is that the rest of us will go on living and giving more to the world to make the life of the one who died more meaningful. Finding the ability to love requires giving up the fear, anguish, and despair that many people nurture. Many people have a lifetime of unresolved anger circulating through their minds and causing new stress with each recall. Confronting them and letting go of them involves honestly facing your own part in the problem and forgiving yourself as well as the others you've resented and feared. If you do not forgive, you become like your enemy. Spirituality, unconditional love, and the ability to see that pain and problems are opportunities for growth and redirection. These things allow us to make the best of the time we have. Then we realize that the present moment is all we have, but it is infinite. We see that there is no real past or future, and that as soon as we start thinking in terms of past and future, regretting and wishing, we lose ourselves in judgmental thinking. In one of the countries where people regularly live to be 100, people have a saying, yesterday is gone, tomorrow isn't here yet, so what is there to worry about? Love and death. 5 days before William Saroyan died in 1981, he called the Associated Press to leave this statement. Everybody has got to die, but I have always believed an exception would be made in my case. Now what? His humor showed how alive one can be even in the face of death. Dying at peace. I'm not saying that we can live as long as we want, but we don't have to die until we are ready. The most obvious proof of this is the time people die in the hospital. The vast majority die in the early hours of the morning when the lifesavers are resting and the family has left or fallen asleep. Then there is no interference with or guilt over leaving. All of us, especially those who are living with serious illness or trauma, are constantly balancing the rewards of life versus the cost of living. One patient told me that as long as she had 5 good minutes a day, she would keep on living. The pain and fear of dying come primarily from conflict, unfinished business, and hanging on so as not to fail one's family. We can learn to live each day as a unit, doing what needs to be done, giving and receiving love, and thus always being prepared to die. As one patient told me, death is not the worst thing. Life without love is far worse. Having mastered the art of living day by day, we can always manage 24 hours if we have an important goal to reach. This postponement can last a long time. I was giving a pep talk on this subject to Melanie, a nurse with breast cancer. She said, "You don't have to tell me that. My mother came home one day when I was 16 and said, 'Girls, I've been told I have leukemia and that I'm going to die within a year. But I am not going to die until you're all married and out of the house.' 8 years later, she attended her youngest daughter's wedding. Many times I have witnessed the death of people who have learned to love fully. It's a peaceful, pain-free letting go in which no time is spent dying. However, two conditions have to be met before this can happen. The doctor as lifesaver must be told when to stop, and loved ones must give the patient permission to go. They must share their love and grief, but let the dying person know that they will be able to survive. In other words, the dying person must not receive a don't die message from the family. He or she must receive their love and support. and the knowledge that the loved ones will survive because they have been loved. The example the dying person has been reveals how precious life is, even as it is being given up. My own father told me about his grandfather, who at the age of 91 said, "Get my friends together and get me a bottle of schnapps. I'm going to die tonight." To humor him, the family complied. That night, after the party, he went upstairs, laid down, and died. Each of us has that option. I might choose to live when someone else might choose to die, but that depends on what we need to accomplish and how much loving remains to be done. Label someone terminal and he is treated as dead. This is wrong. If you are alive, you can still participate by loving, laughing, and living. Before I would accept a quadriplegic's decision to die, I would have him take 1 month of art lessons from another quadriplegic who does incredibly beautiful paintings holding the brush in his mouth. An elderly gentleman had fallen down the stairs and was admitted to the hospital in coma. He and his wife had been married over 60 years. The next day, she had a heart attack and was admitted to the medical service. He was in coma. She was on a respirator, and they were on two different floors. I suggested to the intern that he should let each of them know about the other's condition, since there obviously could be no direct communication. I said, if one dies, the other ought to know what has happened. The interns all thought it was spooky, so I whispered in the ear of each what had happened to the other. The next day I came to the hospital, and the intern said, "Do you know what happened?" I said, "No, what?" He said, "Mr. Smith died," and I had picked up the phone to call the intern on the medical floor to get the number of the niece who was the next of kin. The intern there said, "That's funny, I'm looking for it. What do you need it for?" Mr. Smith had just died, and the other intern said his wife had just died. The wife followed him by 5 minutes. What a gentleman. He went and picked up his wife, and they left together. A drawn-out living death happens when feelings are unspoken, conflicts remain unresolved, and life goes on only for the sake of others. It occurs when the dying one receives don't die messages which define death as a failure, something that must be done in secret when doctors and loved ones are absent. When people achieve peace with themselves and others, it becomes all right to die, to relax and enjoy it, as one of my patients put it. But paradoxically, this very acceptance may produce healing. I felt Valerie was only about 48 hours from death, and because of her husband's reluctance to accept the situation, I decided to help get the family together. On Tuesday night, I explained the situation to her husband and suggested that he call their girls to come home from college. He said he would. On Wednesday night, Valerie talked to me about her husband. "Do you know what he says when you leave?" He says, "Don't die, don't die." I asked her, "Have you ever done anything for yourself in your life?" "No." "Then it's perfectly all right to die," I said. "But before you die, I'd like you to straighten out your relationship with your husband." I came back later that night. Valerie was out of bed, pointing toward her husband, who was standing by the window. She said, "I just told him a few things, some of which he didn't want to hear." On Thursday morning, she was looking wonderful, and she said, "I have two questions. Where did all this energy come from, and why are the nurses in my room all the time now?" I told her, "The nurses are in your room because you're not dying anymore, and the energy comes from resolving your conflict with your husband. I don't know if a miracle will happen, but I think you should get up and go home." "That is a little scary," she said. "I thought I was supposed to die today." Valerie's remission lasted for 2 or 3 months, a little miracle, during which she lived at home, accomplishing beautiful things with her family. She then died peacefully at home, surrounded by love. This example did more for the nursing staff than any number of lectures. They all saw what happens when someone resolves conflicts and finds new energy to heal. If we could do this with all our patients at an earlier stage, not only would they live longer and better, but we would probably increase the number of self-induced cures dramatically. It's amazing how seldom members of the hospital staff visit patients who are close to death. If you shut the door, no one comes in. I was once even questioned about killing someone because of this fear of seeing death. I was in a meeting when I received a call from Muriel, a young woman almost unable to breathe and near death from extensive cancer. She told me, "You say dying's easy." I looked up at the sky and said, "I'm ready," and nothing happened. So I explained, "It's because you're too agitated. I can't get there till 5 o'clock, but then I'll come and help you. If patients want to wait, they will." When I came in, she was filled with fear and anger and had been given no sedation. I tried to tell her that it is hard to die angry and fearful. It keeps you oriented to your body. You have to relax and let go. Then I asked for some morphine, enough to calm her and ease her pain. Because of Muriel's youth, this was a frightening scene for the nurses. They had to be thinking, this could be one of us in that bed. Only a brave medical student was there besides me and the patient's family. After the morphine took effect, her breathing became easier, and we had a wonderful couple of hours filled with love and laughter. She literally came alive again and at one point said she'd be coming back as the first woman president. By 7 o'clock, Muriel looked so much better that I thought maybe she was changing her mind, and I asked her, do you mind if I go get dinner? She said no. I came back in half an hour and she had died. I know that was her way of making it easier for me. The nurses had announced she had died, but when I walked into the room, the intravenous pump was still running and everything else was connected as though she was still alive. The nurses had difficulty dealing with her death. Later that night, I heard that one of the nurses had called an administrator and said I might have killed the patient with morphine. The administrator wouldn't call me because he wasn't an MD, so it worked its way up to the medical chief of staff, who was at a party. The next day, the chief of staff, who knows me well, called me and I explained what had happened. But the part that pained me was the nurse's inability to come into that room. She would have seen how beautiful Muriel's last hours were. These hours are gifts of love that help all the survivors go on. A patient of mine who died recently left me a note saying, thank you for the love. I can take it with me. She healed me and her family and all who touched her. New meaning in life and death. There's a story about two businessmen who were driving to an important meeting. Each was to receive $50,000 tax-free, but they had to get there in 1 hour. On the way, each had a flat tire. The first businessman got out, looked in the trunk, and found he had no jack. He looked at his watch, saw that he had to reach his appointment within 10 minutes, and had a heart attack on the spot. The other businessman looked in the trunk and also saw he had no jack. He stood by the car. A passerby stopped, changed his tire for him, and he made his appointment in time. I subscribe to the Jungian idea of synchronicity or meaningful coincidence. I believe that there are very few accidents. After one of my talks, a man handed me a card in which was written, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. In a life out of harmony with itself, events seem to conspire to go wrong. But by the same token, they mesh wondrously when you start to live your bliss. Perhaps this is another way of saying you create your own opportunities out of the same raw materials from which other people create their defeats. I call these apparent setbacks spiritual flat tires. Unexpected events that can have positive or negative outcomes depending on how we respond to them. One morning, Rose, a student who worked with me, got into her car to come help me in the operating room. Her car broke down, so she got on her bike and it broke. At that point, she said to herself, well, according to Bernie, I belong back in my apartment. She went back, and as she entered her apartment, the phone rang. It was her brother, a former drug addict, calling from Maine. He said, thank God you're there. I was just about to head for New York and go back on drugs. They talked for about an hour. She calmed him, and he promised to stay until another family member could go and be with him. She then went out to her car and lifted the hood, saying to herself, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know anything about engines. At that moment, her other brother drove up and said, I was driving down the parkway, and a voice said to me, go by your sister's house. We fixed her car, and she came to the hospital with her eyes wide open. She will never need another sermon again. To become an authentic spiritual person means to open to our intuition, the part of us that knows. As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has said, decisions based on cold reason alone are usually made to satisfy others. Intuitive decisions make us feel good, even if others think we're crazy. But as we become authentic, we no longer worry about what others think. As a healer, I'm trying to get people to have faith in their own lives and the whole process of life. You can act from that faith and make the rest of your life simple, or you can keep testing and make the rest of your life difficult. No matter what good things happen, you'll always be able to say, it could be a coincidence, and never enjoy the grace. Instead, I counsel you to choose your direction, make the leap of faith, and fly. How do you know if you have faith? The only way I can explain it is to tell you about the man who fell over the side of a cliff, grabbed hold of a very small bush, and was hanging there watching its roots gradually pull loose. At that moment, he looked up toward heaven and said, "God, you have to save me." And a beautiful, melodious voice said, "Don't worry, my son, I'll save you. Let go." The man looked back up and said, "Is anybody else up there?" If you don't have to ask that second question, you have faith. There are hidden channels of communication from the unconscious to our conscious minds. Since I've made patients understand that it's safe to tell me any experience they've had, I've encountered cases of precognition many times. One Monday, I operated on a man named Mike, who had a massive hemorrhage from an aneurysm that had ruptured into his esophagus. It was impossible to stop the bleeding, and he died. When I talked to his wife, she said, "You know, Sunday we spent the whole day discussing his funeral and will, and I said, why do we have to talk about all this morbid business? And now I know." Several times I found that close relatives knew of a person's death before they had received news of it. My own father, who is now almost 80, told me that his mother visited him spiritually one day at work when he was a young man. She said goodbye. He knew she had died, and he grew terribly sad. His co-workers noticed, but he couldn't tell them what had happened because it sounded crazy. As soon as he got home, the phone rang, and his sister told him their mother had died. Sandy told me her experience of the same intuitive knowledge. Her husband, Harry, always drove the kids to school. But one day, all three of them were late getting dressed. He got angry and left without them, and a few minutes later was killed in an accident. It seems obvious to me that there was an unconscious awareness in each of those children that this was not the day to get dressed and go with Dad. When Sandy called Harry's mother in Maine and started to talk, his mother said, "Yes, I know. Harry's dead." When asked how she knew, she replied, "His father, who'd been dead a year, came to me last night and said, 'I have to take our son tomorrow.'" These are the kinds of things that patients share with me, the privileged listener. One night, when I was giving a lecture, I had all my notes in front of me. And yet, as I was giving the talk, I realized that, in a sense, two talks were being given. In one, I was struggling to follow the outline, but something else was coming out of my mouth. I realized the other talk was much better, so I finally just gave in and let it happen. When I came off the stage, I told Bobby, "I don't know who gave the talk. I didn't." The next woman who came up to me said, "I've heard you before, but that was more moving than usual." The third person who came up to me said, "I'm a medium, and while you were reading a letter superimposed over you, staring at the audience, was this figure. I drew him for you." And she showed me a picture of my guide, George. This experience taught me that the unconscious can take care of everything, and I don't have to prepare for my lectures anymore. Whether George exists as a spiritual guide or simply exists inside of me as part of my collective unconscious or intuition, the power is there for all of us. We will let it come through. As Socrates replied when asked if he had prepared his defense, "What needs to be said will be said." Death is no barrier to this intuitive spiritual consciousness. It continues after death, and it communicates between the dead and the living. Iris, a blind diabetic who developed cancer, underwent a similar experience. One day she called her two daughters into her hospital room and told them, "Girls, I can see again. My mother and father came for me and held out an apple. They said when I bite into it, I will join them. I told them my grandson's birthday was on Tuesday, and I would join them then." She died after the party on Tuesday. Before she passed away, one of her daughters said, "Mom, if you die, I want to die too. I can't go on without you." 2 weeks later, Iris appeared to her daughter and said, "Look, I have 10 minutes. This is against the rules. I am in a beautiful place and I am loved. I can't be worrying about you doing something silly." As I have opened myself to my patients' beliefs, I have received many messages from those who have died. Josie was a wonderful woman who had given everyone who knew her the gift of love and humor. While at the hospice, for example, she thought she heard a noise and asked if someone was at the door. The nurse said, "Oh, I just kicked your bucket." And Josie replied, "I'm here trying to kick the bucket, and for you it's easy." She was one of those exceptional people who lived until the moment of death. Josie had asked me to deliver the eulogy at her funeral. I said I would be honored, but told her I couldn't be sure my schedule would permit it, especially since the funeral would be held in New York. Months before, I had arranged to be in New York on a certain Friday for a conference, the only day in the entire year I was scheduled to be in New York. Then a radio talk show host asked me to speak for an hour at noon on that day. Since I would already be in the city, I agreed. But on the Monday before the show, someone from the station called and said the program had been preempted. I told my wife that Josie's funeral would be at that time, although she hadn't died yet. On Tuesday evening, Josie's husband asked me how to help ease her passage. She found it hard to leave amid the constant visiting and expressions of love. I suggested he tell her he loved her, that he and the boys would be okay, and she could go if she was ready. He shared that with her the next morning, and then turned to get her breakfast tray. When he turned back, she had died. Josie's son called me to tell me she had died, and there had been a debate about whether to have the funeral Friday or Sunday. I said, "Your mother wants it at noon on Friday." He said, "I don't know how you know, but that's what we decided." After I'd learned of Josie's death, I went to meditate in the hospital chapel, a small closet-like room with no windows. A plaque on the wall suddenly began to shake for no discernible reason. I looked at it and read the message. "In the midst of life, I am with you." I knew it was a message from Josie. On Friday, as I was nearing the end of my eulogy, the loudspeaker in the funeral home suddenly went off. I felt that was another message from Josie saying, "Enough already." Paula, one of our ECAP group members, told me of a similar experience after her daughter was murdered in a brutal assault at her college. At the murderer's trial, a bird appeared in the window, making an awful racket and disturbing the proceedings. Paula said she knew it was her daughter because she always demanded a lot of attention. Later, at the wedding of Paula's other daughter, another bird appeared, cackling raucously, interrupting the outdoor ceremony. Then, after Paula finished telling this story in the group, a bird began squawking at the window, and everyone turned to Paula and said, "I guess that's your daughter again." Recently, I was out jogging on a cold, dark December morning. A bird followed me for half an hour, chirping and sharing with me. When I came home, I said to Bobby, "Someone died and just said goodbye." Wednesday, I got a phone call and learned that a patient I'd been very close to, who was in another state, had died at that time. Perhaps my most dramatic experience of after-death communication concerns Bill, the physician who knew he had cancer after one instance of difficulty in swallowing. He joined ECAP, but always remained somewhat distant, quiet, and observant. His wife had told others he never bought the package. 3 months after Bill had died of his cancer, a young college student came to my office to interview me. She said she'd been in a healing circle the night before. The medium who was directing the circle had asked if there was any message for me. She handed me a card. "To Bernie from Bill. With love and peace. If I had known it was this easy, I'd have bought the package a long time ago and wouldn't have resisted so much." When I called his wife, she said, "That's what he always told me after the meetings he would attend, but he said he couldn't buy the package. When he was quite sick, I asked him if he was ready to die. He said, considering the alternative, no." The people in the healing circle knew nothing about who Bill was, yet there was the same phrase he and his wife used. "Love and peace" is the closing I use for all my letters. Who else could this note be from? How can I help but believe and share this belief with others? But whatever explanation you prefer for these experiences, there's no denying that learning to love conquers the fear of death and can liberate incredible healing energy. The closing lines of Emmett Fox's sermon are the key. "If only you could love enough, you would be the happiest, most powerful being in the world. You become invulnerable. This, I feel, is the real future of medicine. Scientists often say you must see in order to believe, but I know you must believe in order to see. In medicine and science, we are generally told seeing is believing, and then we are told what to see and to ignore everything else. However, the spiritual message heeded by the true explorer or artist is to open our eyes and see beyond what we have been told exists. It is my fervent hope that by showing adults how the mind and spirit can heal the body and make life worthwhile, I can help us, as parents, raise a generation of children programmed to be loving and healthy. Too many children get everything they want and nothing they need. The message to whisper in your child's ear is simply, I love you unconditionally, not if you get an A or become a doctor. Life is full of hurdles, but whatever happens, you'll overcome. The whole world must confront the same issues, for nuclear weapons threaten the world as cancer threatens the individual. If we decide to love, we have a much greater chance of surviving. If we love, we will control the few who are comfortable being killers. As Gandhi said, we must not kill our enemies, but kill their desire to kill. In India, the story is told of a holy man who stayed in his monastery when an army was advancing through the area and killing all the holy men. When a general said, don't you know I can thrust my sword into your stomach? He replied, don't you know I can place my stomach around your sword? If we love enough, we become invulnerable, and we can place our stomachs around the sword and save the world. In India, there is also the traditional saying, when you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a manner that when you die, the world cries, and you rejoice. If we can live in accordance with that simple teaching, we will survive as individuals and the world will survive as well. Gandhi's teacher Muktananda remarked that Sanskrit has no word for exclusion. When we can kill our own desire to kill and learn to exclude no one, the world will change and we will return from whence we came, from the energy that chose to love out of its own intelligence. I often tell my patients that there are two ways to be immortal. One is to go to medical school. Doctors don't get sick and don't die. And the other is to love someone. As Thornton Wilder expressed at the end of The Bridge of St. Louis Ray, and we ourselves shall be loved for a while and forgotten. But the love will have been enough. All those impulses of love return to the love that made them. Even memory is not necessary for love. There is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love, the only survival, the only meaning. God has given us free will to make love and life meaningful. This creates a critical risk because we now have the ability to destroy our universe if we choose not to love. However, it is only in this critical time that the archetype of the miracle can appear. When one believes in love and miracles, divine intervention can occur. We have an infinite number of choices ahead, but a finite number of endings. There are destruction and death, or love and healing. If we choose the path of love, we save ourselves and our universe. Let us choose love and life. Thank you. I would like to give you a short example of the type of relaxation and guided imagery that we normally utilize and which is contained in the book. find a comfortable place to sit down or lie down and just begin to breathe deeply. Take a deep breath of peace, of life, and breathe out your conflicts and fears. And when you're ready, let your eyes close slowly. And then let a wave of peace move down through your body, relaxing the neck and jaw muscles and shoulder muscles. You might even give it a color and just let the peace move down through your body, repeating a word like peace or relax with each breath. And just settle down. And then I'd like you to remember back to your school days. The blackboard covered with writing and chalk, and the teacher picking up a big sponge and washing the board clean. And I'd like you to erase the blackboard of your mind, clearing it of all thoughts and conflicts and troubles, because I'm going to take you to the middle of nowhere, to your corner of the universe, a safe place that you'll create for yourself with its vivid textures, aromas, sounds, and feelings. And be aware of all the vivid colors that surround you. And find yourself entering this scene and sitting down or lying down and taking a moment to help make yourself well. If there is any disease present within your body, see your treatment and your immune system eliminating that disease. And then fill your body with light and love. And if there is no disease present, just fill your body with light and love. And take these moments to help make yourself well. And when you've completed that, I'd like you to follow my voice again and build a bridge between your universe and ours. It'll connect with a path that represents your path, through fields and meadows, by streams and ponds and mountains. And build that bridge. And be aware as you build it what kind of a connection you have with the universe. What kind of a bridge is there in terms of strength and distance and width? Because it's a bridge that you communicate across. And then walk across the bridge and start on your path, feeling it beneath your feet, being aware of the sunlight and the shade, perhaps a breeze. And find a lovely place where you'd like to plant a seed. And dig up the soil and plant it. And then become that seed. And put down roots to give you strength and firmness and stability. And the strength to push against obstacles so that you can break out into the sunlight. And feel the strength of your trunk and limbs as you grow and bloom. Watch yourself become a beautiful flower. Unique, authentic, individual, and beautiful as you are. And the softness of the petal, the aroma, the color. Allow yourself to grow and bloom and blossom. And when you have completed that, again, follow my voice, and find another quiet place to stretch out in a meadow. And take a moment to become small enough to enter your own body. And go through your body, opening every cell to light and love, creating a harmony amongst the organs, walking down the corridors of your brain and entering the rooms and clearing the shelves of old junk, and making changes and adjustments to help your immune system and circulation. And just go through your body and repair it. Create the person you would like to be. When you have completed that, take a look at yourself in the mirror and look out of the mirror at yourself and listen to what the mirror has to say, what you have to say. And when you have heard and learned all that is to be said, come together and embrace yourself. Give yourself the love and affection you deserve. And then become one with yourself again. And let that one again become aware of my voice and your breathing. And the pressures against your body where you may be sitting or lying down. And let each breath bring you back a little more alert and a little more at peace with each breath. Until when you're ready, you return to the room, alert and awake, yet at peace. When you are ready, beginning now.